Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Catherine Yardley about her contemporary novel, Ember. Catherine has been writing since she was a child, and says she's happiest when she's reading or writing. She loves women's fiction because she believes women have the right to have their stories told in all their messy, complex glory. In this episode, we discuss writing sibling relationships, how acting helps her create characters, and the snobbery surrounding women's fiction. But first, here's Catherine with an excerpt from Ember.
I need you to get out of the car. What? Rob asks. I need you to get out of the car, I say again, trying to be as calm as possible. Rob stares at me and blinks. Then he looks around. It is getting darker. We are in the middle of nowhere. He was startled awake by the car lurching forward. He looks at me and blinks again. He was sleeping when I put my foot on the brake and he's still half asleep. I look back at him, trying to keep all of my emotions down. I need you to open a door and get out of the car. I can tell he's trying to figure out what the hell is happening. What? I need you to get out of the car, I say again. The irritation in my voice makes me hate myself. Finally, he opens the door and swings his legs out. He hesitates for the rest of his body follows. Then he spins back around and looks at me again, his hand on the door. He is nonplussed, I can tell, almost shell-shocked. Please take a step back and close the door. He does as I ask, and I drive off. As I do, I hear him coming out of his fuzz to yell, "That is actually my fucking car." Driving is usually how I relax, but not tonight. Tonight, something had broken in me. Trying to behave normally was exhausting. I just wanted to scream at the top of my voice. It would be dark in a couple of hours and dusk was already starting to make its mark. The only thing that's bright is the headlights of the car. I think back to what just happened, how gorgeous Rob looked as he slept. His profile was beautiful. I always loved his strong, straight nose, his high cheekbones and his perfect jaw. His face took my breath away. I felt lucky every moment he was in my life, which is why I tried to ignore the seed that had been planted inside of me. A seed that was growing at an exponential rate. I felt like a cancer that would take away everything that I have, and yet I had not managed to stop the growth. I put my foot on the brake fast and heavy. Then it was done, leaving only self-hatred and hollowness. I closed my eyes and the tears come.
Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you here with me today to discuss your debut novel, Ember.
Thank you for having me, Chloe.
Can you start by kind of giving us an outline of the plot of your novel?
Yeah, I can. So Ember's basically about Natalie. Her younger sister, Amanda, gets married and pregnant before her. And Natalie's the one who's planning her wedding. She's the maid of honor. And Amanda wants their father to come to the wedding. And their father walked out on him on Christmas Day, like 30 years ago. And Amanda doesn't, Natalie doesn't really speak to her father anymore. So there's quite a few different things happening. And it's just like their father's infidelity just tore their family apart. And then Natalie has been in a relationship with her boyfriend for a very long time. They're not married. They don't have children. And it just kind of, her life just kind of unravels from this kind of unhealed wound, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, we also get the perspective of the mother character and how the infidelity and the father walking out impacted her as well, don't we?
Yeah, I love that character.
So where did your inspiration for this come from? Was it something that kind of developed over time, or did you have like a light bulb moment? What was the process for your inspiration?
So the inspiration was, I actually wrote this as a film script. I used to work in the film industry, and I wanted to write, I don't have a sister, so basically I have two older brothers, and I kind of always wanted a sister, so I kind of wanted to write a book about, initially it was three sisters, and I just kind of wanted to add some drama in. And it, the book is completely different from that now. It really changed over time. But what I really wanted to write about was how something can happen in our lives and we carry it with us for the rest of our lives, or almost rest of our lives, but we don't realize we're carrying it. It affects everything we do. It affects our relationship with other people. And I just really wanted to explore that. You know, our childhood echoes into our future.
So what was your process when you first started? Are you the kind of writer that just kind of writes to see what happens, or did you have a character in mind when you started writing?
So my process is that I have an idea, and I kind of know the characters, and then once I have an idea which is fully realized, that's key, and then I know the characters, I write 2,000 to 3,000 words a day until the book is finished. With Ember, it was a little different. What I did was I reread the script, and then it's the only time I've ever done it like this, obviously. But and then I wrote, the script was there, and then I deleted the black part of the script, and then I wrote it as a novel. And I think that kind of helped a lot with the structure of the book. And then every draft, it became completely different after every draft. I mean, there's a love story in it now. It's romance as well. I think every draft became clearer and deeper. And I think that's why doing lots of different drafts helps.
What made you decide then, you had this film script, and what made you think, no, it's got to be a novel?
Basically, it's so hard to get a film made and it's so expensive. But I wrote another novel. I used to be an actor and I did that for a very long time. So I wrote a novel set in the acting world. And I finished the first draft of that. And then I thought, you know, I want to write another novel. And it's like, I need another idea now. So I thought, I have this film script, I'll rewrite that as a novel. So that's just what I did.
So you just kind of gave it a go and thought, I'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing to lose.
Yeah, exactly. Can you explain the meaning of the title for us, the Ember title?
Yeah, it was initially called something else. And I won't actually say what the old title was, because I think it might actually get, it gives away too much of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's called Ember just because I think it kind of encapsulates that thing of just like a dying fire, when there's just like, there's still something there and it can go out, or maybe it can spark again. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of fitted into fits into the romance part of it, but also it fits into the fact that even when we think something has stopped, the dying fires are still there.
Yeah, it's the long-standing kind of resentments within the family.
They
definitely have potential to, and they do in the novel kind of spark back up again when they meet.
Yeah.
And certain things happen. So you explore this very kind of difficult, complicated family dynamic in the novel, and you look at issues such as forgiveness and grief, and they're quite tough subjects because they don't really have a easy resolution. There's not kind of a, particularly in families, I think, and many people experience this in real life, nothing's kind of magically fixed. It takes a long time. And that's something you've tried to explore in the novel. So I was wondering how that worked when you were writing it. Were there, when you were sort of, how did you develop those kind of long-standing grudges? Did you have them all in your head when you started writing, or were there things that came out when you started writing dialogue where you suddenly discovered that there was a conflict you weren't aware of?
What was really interesting about this book is that when I was writing it, the Prince Harry and Meghan thing, I think with the very last draft I was writing, like, that kind of happened as well. And I found that, and when I was submitting it to people, I was saying, like, this is a timely book because of Mexit, you know? It's just about, you know, if you think about our relationship with our siblings, our longest relationship in life is with our siblings. There's no other relationship that is that long. And, you know, you have different personalities, you have different people, and then sometimes something can happen, and other people are annoying, you know. They say hell is other people. Well, hell is your siblings, because, you know, you love them, but sometimes you don't like them. Or another thing is that the people who you are in childhood, other people still think you're that person. And I think everybody has a difficult person in their family. And everybody says you should forgive your family. And family is the most important thing in life. But I think what the novel explores is family the most important thing in life? Should people be in our life just because we're related to them? Mm. Even if they're toxic, even if they hurt us, even if they cause us damage? And people always say, yes, because family is so important. But I think the most important thing in life is love and true love. And being treated with love and respect, because they say your friends are the family that you choose. And yeah, and I think the other thing is that people do hold grudges. It's so human. People hold grudges, they have resentments. And sometimes you won't even know. I mean, I had a falling out with a family member, which obviously I won't go into. I had a horrible falling out with a family member about something that happened years and years and years ago, which I had not even realized they were upset about.
Mm.
So it's just, it's very relevant, I think.
While we're on the subject of love and true love, we need to talk about the relationship between Natalie and Rob in this novel. Yeah. And when we first meet them, it's not in a very happy situation. They're not in a great place. So I was wondering what kind of work you did to create their love story. Are you the sort of person that creates all these massive kind of character sheets? Or do you go with the flow a bit more?
Do you know, I don't do character sheets. I think at one point I did write down, like, Natalie, what she looked like and some things about her, but I am not a planner at all. My characters are very real for me. They're people who, like, they're walking around. They're very, like, to me, they're real people. Obviously, like, when the book's done, I kind of move on to other book, but because I studied acting, and when you study acting, what they tell you is that everything about a person tells you something about them, the way they move, the way they think, the way they speak, the clothes they wear, everything. And as a writer, that is immensely helpful. And it actually be good for writers to take an acting class or to do some acting, maybe, because you learn that everything about someone tells you something about them. And it gets, you can then get very deep into a character in a very good way.
So how did you develop that love story then? How did you decide that Natalie and Rob were the one for each other?
They've got quite a funny relationship where they have all of these funny things. Kind of, it's like the removing the barbs thing, you know, like Natalie's a rose covered in thorns. Some people use this analogy when they're talking about romance writing, and then eventually you remove the barbs and you remove the barbs. And she is struggling, and people think, I mean, she's a very accomplished person. She's a doctor. She's in her late 30s. And people think that if you're in your late 30s and you're accomplished, then you just have everything together. And she wasn't loved as a child, and she didn't get to have a childhood. So in a way, her father coming back brings out the child in her again.
Mm.
And when she breaks up with Rob, she breaks up with him for him. She loves him. So she tries to sacrifice herself for him. And he doesn't give up on her. And in the end, she exposes her vulnerability, I think, and she allows herself. She kind of allows herself to be loved, which is what we all need to do. We all need to allow ourselves to be loved. You have to be vulnerable enough to be loved.
I want to speak a little bit about Natty, because she's an interesting character, because she doesn't, she has very strong opinions on what society expects of her. And she's very much like, she feels the pressure of her family asking her when she's going to have kids and when she's going to get married. And was that an aspect you were really keen on exploring in this book?
It was, yes, because I think it's so unfair on women, especially women in their 30s. People are always talking about our wombs, when we're going to have children, when we're going to have more children. And it's a huge amount of pressure. I mean, I don't think men realise just how much pressure it is being a woman and having a biological clock. And especially if you want to have children and that in time is ticking on.
Mm.
It is very, I mean, I had a male friend once say to me that women in their mid-30s are terrified and terrifying. And it enraged me in a way, because I thought, you know, it is probably true. You know, I'm lucky because I have children. But it's just like, when I wrote the book, I didn't have children. It tells you how long it takes to write a book, get it published. I didn't have children. So the question of children wasn't a question mark over my head when I wrote this book. And I wanted to have children. So in a way, I put my insecurities of society and my own insecurities into the book as well. But it's really tough. You know, everybody keeps going on at her, like, when are you going to get married? When are you going to have children? And it's like, she's a doctor. She's accomplished. She has her own life. She's living a good life. She's happy, you know? Why does it matter? We have this old-fashioned view of how women should live and be. And why can't we just be ourselves? Why can't we just live our lives the way men are allowed to? Matthew Perry doesn't have children. No one even knows. Jennifer Aniston doesn't have children. It's a big news story.
Yeah, that's all the time,
even now.
Yeah, I noticed in your, I think it's in your author's note, that it said how much you enjoy writing women's fiction because you feel like women deserve to have their kind of like messy selves written about. It's not these kind of, you want to write flawed female characters. How do you feel about that kind of stigma that's attached to, well, I guess it's snobbery attached to women's fiction genre?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? And would you like to see attitudes towards the genre change?
I would, yeah. There's only a woman in it. They say women's fiction because it's about women's lives. And when it's men's fiction, I don't say,
there's no men's fiction category, is there?
Exactly, yeah. And it is tremendously sexist. I mean, one of my favourite genres is women's fiction. And I'm saying that with quotation marks, you know, the whole bunny ears thing. And it is sexist. I think basically people can't think of a different way to describe it. And that way's clearly marketable. You know, the publishing industry decided that this is how they sell books. But there's a huge stigma about anything to do with women. I mean, apparently men don't read a lot of fiction by women, and you have to wonder why. I mean, I love reading books about men and how they think. You know, maybe they'd learn more about us and it'd be a better world.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the point of view in your novel, because you've got sections which are set in the present, and then you've got sections that go back to the past. And as I've mentioned, you explore the story from the mother's point of view, from when she split with her husband, and you also explore Rob's point of view. So I was wondering why you picked kind of a multiple POV story rather than just kind of going with one character, going with, say, Natalie's story.
Yeah. So initially it was all written in past tense, kind of past tense third person. And I read it, and actually I sent it off to someone called Claire Dyer, who's a very good novelist. And she said, I think it, this book would be better if it was written in the first tense. And I was like, oh my God, don't say that to me. Please, 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 please. And she thought, and I read it, and I was actually quite embarrassed that I sent it out in that state, because after I read it again, I read that draft. It was a terrible, terrible novel, and it was written so badly. I might be over-exaggerating, but I completely, the book from when I sent it out to her to when I rewrote it is completely different. And then I did actually send it out again to someone called Margaret Graham, who is a best-selling author and who's a really, really lovely person. And she liked it when I sent it to her and she read it. But I think I had to get really deep into the characters. And the best way to do that was to get to tell their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think dual timeline is actually quite popular at the moment. I think a lot of authors are doing that. And I didn't actually realize I'd done dual timeline initially. But I've noticed a lot of novels now are kind of set in the 90s and then set in the present day in the same way that Ember is. But yeah, I think I just wanted to write the characters to tell their own story.
Mm.
I thought it worked better that way.
What made you write from Jacqueline's point of view? Because I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she's not alive in the present. So what made you decide to tell her story then?
Do you know what? Telling her story meant so much to me because Jacqueline to me is every woman who has sacrificed herself for her children and her husband or just anyone who cares for anyone. And she gets no respect for it, you know, and at some point Natalie has a terrible relationship with her mother because she takes her father back and then she sees her dad cheating on her mother. She doesn't respect her mother and she doesn't see that there's a full picture. You know, children can be so cruel and they have a very limited view of the world at that point. They don't see the nuance. But I had to tell her story and I want to tell her story in her own voice because she just had to have it. It's for the sake of feminism, for the sake of all of these women who sacrificed so much and end up not getting a fair time, basically.
So do you feel like when you wrote this family, you had characters in there that you empathized more with than others? And do you feel like you, I guess, because Natalie is, I would say, I guess, the main character, do you feel like you empathize with her most?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think Natalie's, she can be a bit difficult and she can be like a little bit unlikable and she kind of gets in her own way quite a lot.
Mm.
So she can be a bit infuriating, but she's very human and she's very real. And I think there was a point where we weren't allowed to write books where women were real women and they weren't messy, but the men were allowed to. And I've noticed there's a lot of books coming out now where the women are just real, well-rounded people. Because I had an early reader say, Natalie acts erratic quite a lot of the time. Can you explain to us why that may be? And I'm just like, it's just her. She's allowed to. She's a human being. She's allowed her own personality. She's allowed to be triggered by things, you know? I mean, you take a human being and there's so much to them and there's so much to their past and their present and people are deep, you know? And we should be writing about that in books rather than just thinking, oh yes, they're just perfect and they behave all of the time.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So you said already that you sent your book off in its early stages to a couple of authors that you knew to give you some feedback. So how did that kind of work in terms of shaping your novel? You said that one of the writers said they thought that a novel would be better in a different perspective. So how do you think that feedback helped you? And did you have like beta readers and stuff? How did that work?
So if the people who read it were Claire and Margaret. I think my husband might have read a very, very early draft, like 6-7 years ago. I'm not sure he read it all. He's not really my target audience. not because he's a man, hopefully, but because he likes fantasy and kind of sci-fi. He doesn't really read that type of books. But my husband's really brutal with his feedback. And then Claire gave really good feedback. But I didn't really send out to a lot of people, though I think that's a really good way for a writer to realize, because otherwise you're just doing draft after draft and you just do not know if it's good or not. But I'm lucky now that when I do a draft, I send it to my agent, and she is a great editor and she gives great feedback. I'm so lucky to have her. She's really good.
Yeah, that's really useful to get someone else's perspective. Like you say, when you're editing constantly, you're seeing the same things, the same problems with it, and sometimes getting someone else's perspective helps you see things, see what the issue is sometimes, I think. And if you're getting the same comments from a couple of people, then you start to think maybe there is something wrong with it.
I agree with that, because if one person says something, it's their opinion, but if everybody's saying the same thing, then there's something wrong with it. And you don't notice certain things about your book because you're so in it, you know these characters, you know the story, but someone else reads it and you're like, oh yeah, that doesn't make sense. You do need it.
And sometimes it's even little things. I was speaking to another debut the other day, Laura Price, and she was saying that her editors kept telling her there's too many cups of tea in this novel. You know, your characters are always making cups of tea. And when you've been, you know, if you've got like a 300 page manuscript, you've read it so many times, you don't pick up on those things. You need that external person to help you see your way through the wood from the trees, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I had lots of characters turning, so it's like, oh, he turned, and I was like, oh god, if I see the word turned again, I will go insane. But yeah, every writer has those little things which they do, like bad habits.
Words that crop up way too many times. I know we've all I know you have been writing since you were very, very small. You've always been scribbling away at something. So did you always dream of becoming an author and writing a novel?
I did, yeah. So when I was like really young, I wrote just on sheets of paper and a novel. I think I got to like 14 and a half pages before I realised I didn't have a plot or anything else. But I've always written. I wrote a poem when I was in high school, and my English teacher said, "This is amazing, it's outstanding, it's so good." And he really, really, he told me I was a good writer and that I could be a writer. And I remember I took it home, and I showed it to my mother, and I was really proud. And I sent some poems out, and I got one in an anthology. And that was just what it took. For me to realize that, because I read a book a day. I mean, I still sometimes read a book a day if my children let me. But I love reading and I love writing. I mean, that's pretty much my entire life. It's not really, it's just something. I think sometimes you're just kind of, it's just who you are. Even if no one read my novels, I would still write. It's something that I need to do.
So you've already said you're not much of a planner, so you don't have all your kind of spreadsheets and post-it notes, but I was wondering what your kind of ideal writing day is like. I know you, I think you've recently joined TikTok and you've been talking about how to write alongside having a family and obviously the challenges that come with that. So for you, what's a kind of perfect writing day look like then?
My perfect writing day, I would drop my children off at school. I'd come home, my baby would take a nap, and then I would write. And sometimes that does happen. And then I get to write for 2-3 hours. He doesn't nap that long. I can nap for 2 hours. But my ideal writing day would be, I have no idea what it's like to just be able to write all day. And one day my youngest will be in school and I will have just like 6 hours to myself where I will just write. And then sometimes I think, what will happen, where I'll go, what I'll do, you know, that type of thing where you just think it'll be a completely different reality. But and then again, there won't be the same chaos that I have now, which I actually love, obviously.
So are you the type of writer that can kind of squeeze writing in where you've got available time, like even if it's only for 10 minutes, or do you like to sit and just get, I know you said you can sometimes write up to 3,000 words a day, which is an amazing amount of words. Do you prefer to kind of do it in bigger chunks when you have them?
So basically I can write 1,000 words an hour because I need to be able to do that. But the thing is concentrating, because I get distracted very easily and I want to go onto Twitter or I want to go onto TikTok or I hear a good song and I want to listen to the song, or I go to the fridge and I go eat some chocolate. So I have to kind of just set myself down and concentrate. And concentration is probably the hardest thing for me. It's something that I need to kind of work on. But how I wrote my first book, actually, my acting novel, was I wheeled my son around in his pram until he fell asleep. And I wrote the 2,000 to 3,000 words on my iPhone. That's how I wrote my first novel. And then my third one, I wrote a lot of it when my kids were sleeping, between 9 p.m. and I think midnight, 1 a.m. I wrote and edited. So it's just kind of finding, it's just finding the time, I think. But yeah, I can really get into the flow. My favorite thing about writing is writing a first draft where you just write and it's fun and it's flowing. And then my least favorite is when you have to edit the words and they're a mess.
I'm a big advocate of writing on your phone. I do it as well. I think it's a great way. I sometimes even just write a sentence and then I know I have it there to come back to when I've got more time. But it's a great way of, I guess it's like the modern equivalent of carrying around a notebook and pen with you everywhere. I know people that email themselves some work and things. That's quite a good way of doing it, so you don't lose it. Do you think that kind of concentration thing is your biggest challenge to overcome when you're writing, or is there something else that is more of an obstacle to you when you're writing?
It's kind of finding time. It's the concentration. Because when I finally get down time to write, there's a lot of things, like there's always a lot of things that need done. And there's my to-do list is always really long. So I think before I got published, I didn't know if writing was just something that I was doing for myself. Sometimes it felt a bit selfish, And I think that's the problem with women, is we think if we do something for ourselves, it's selfish, whereas men can do something for themselves all of the time. And that's what we need to get past. So now it's just sitting down, saying, this is worth it. This is what I love. And it's now a career, because I publish and I have an agent. So I'm going to sit down, I'm going to concentrate, I'm going to write, and I'm going to edit. Yeah, and not check Twitter and not check TikTok.
I wanted to speak as well about your online magazine, Frost Magazine. I just wondered whether you could tell us a little bit about that, how it started. You've been running it for quite a few years now.
Yeah, 12 years.
Wow.
Such a long time. It blows my mind, actually. So I started that 12 years ago. It's a lifestyle magazine. It's books and lifestyle. I started it. I just wanted to, I moved to London, I didn't know anybody, and I wanted to interview people and I wanted to go to things, and I thought that was the best way. But we do lots of stuff with offers. We do the 5 books that changed me. We do a writing process. Jane Cable, who's a very successful author, she's the contributing editor, and Margaret Graham, who's, again, who I mentioned before, who's a fantastic best-selling author. She's the editor, and then I'm the editor-in-chief. And we do reviews, we do restaurant reviews. I once went to Toulouse, flown first class to Toulouse, and I reviewed restaurants and went to festivals. And yeah, it's a really nice family, Frost Magazine is. It's a really great bunch of contributors who just love writing and writing about books, writing about food and reviewing stuff. Yeah, I love it.
I will add the link to your online magazine in the show notes when it's uploaded. So I wondered whether you have some, you've been writing this novel for a long time. You must have read a lot of writing advice and gained a lot of knowledge through that. So I was wondering if you could give us your top 3 tips for writers working on their first novel.
Okay, my top 3 tips. Number 1, write it. Get it done. Finish it. Number 2, don't listen to anyone who is negative in any way about your writing. You can write this book. You have a story. You have a voice. And number 3, this is the most top tip. Once you're finished and you've edited it, have the courage to send it to people. Because so many people I know want to be writers and are too scared to send a work out, and you can't be a writer unless you submit your work and you send it to other people. So just be brave, know your worth, and do it.
Great, that's really confidence building advice there. So I was wondering whether you could give us some comparison novels to compare to Ember, novels that you think kind of share a similar space or share similar themes. What books do you think that kind of sit nicely with your book?
You know, that's a really good question, because, you know, when you submit to agents and stuff, they always ask you to compare your novel to other novels. And that's the thing I struggled most with. I was like, how can I compare my book to other books that I've read and that I love? You know, it seemed a bit, I was worried people would think that's arrogant or something. I think then I actually look back at the novels I compared my book to, and one was by Kate Murray Brown called The Upstairs Room. It's a really good book. It's kind of, they say it's kind of like a ghost story. It's about there's a ghost in the upstairs room, but fundamentally that book is about relationships. And when I read that book, I was really impressed, and it kind of opened my eyes to what I was doing with my book, which is writing a book about relationships and people. Because I think some people can be quite, it's that whole women's fiction thing again, where they're quite snooty if you're writing about people in relationships, you know. Mm. If someone's not dead on page 10, they're like, this has no worth. So I think Kate Murray Brown, when I read Sorrow and Bliss, I kind of felt, I'm not comparing my book to Sorrow and Bliss because I thought that was a masterpiece, but I kind of felt it had similarities to my book. They both have female characters that are a bit, there's no mental illness in my book, but they'll have female characters who are like, they're very much themselves. They're acting kind of a certain way, and they have lots of stuff going on with their family and their lives. I think Meg Mason, she writes so honestly and unflinchingly. And then I think the other people that I wrote was Adele Parks, I hope, because Adele Parks is just a writing goddess, and B.A. Paris, and then Sheila O'Flanagan. And then the last one was actually Sophie Cousins. She wrote, oh my God, Sophie, she's such a good writer. She's amazing. Have you read her books?
No, I know of her, but I don't think I've read anything of hers, no.
She's written two books, This Time Last Year, and then Just Haven't Met You Yet. And I've read both of them, and they're both so good. They're so deep in their characterization, and they're really good.
Mm. So finally, are you able to tell us about what you're writing now or your next project?
Yeah, so I have a book on submission. That's the acting book set in the acting world. And then I have another book that's gained some interest, hopefully, fingers crossed. It's kind of like a Mean Girls of Mortgages book. Mm-hmm. It's set in school, you know, it's like a PTA book. So it's like a school gate. Mm. And the mother's kind of, it's how misunderstandings happen between people, and then things escalate from those misunderstandings.
Mm.
And then I've written another book called Race to the Altar, about a couple who break up and then competitively try to get married before each other. And yeah, and then I wrote a short story collection. So hopefully, fingers crossed, I will get deals for all of those. We'll have to see.
Well, I think your Mean Girls of Mortgages is a great pitch. So yeah. I wish you luck with pitching them and all your other writing projects. I'm still blown away by the 3,000 words a day thing. So you're going to be very busy.
Yeah, indeed I will be.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for coming on the podcast to speak with me today.
No, thank you for having me. I love your podcast. I've listened to all of them.
That was Catherine Yardley talking about her debut contemporary novel, Ember, which is out now and available to buy. Before I go, let me just tell you about two events I've got coming up where I'm hosting this podcast, Confessions of a Debut Novelist, live. First, I'm going to be talking to three authors at the Being a Writer Festival, hosted by the Literary Consultancy, on June the 28th. Then on July the 22nd, I'm going to be talking to Louise Morrish, about her historical novel at Jericho Writers Summer Festival. Both of these events are virtual, so you can join anywhere in the world and even ask questions. Thank you so much for listening, and if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.